offer.
Don't you always want to be the best you can be?
The Frankie Boyer Show.
What is this?
It's more than a lifestyle show.
It's a show about living in today's world.
I think something is happening.
Frankie enthusiastically brings an amazing eclectic mix to the airwaves.
You got that right.
One of the reasons she's earned legions of loyal fans is very simple. When you listen to The Frankie Boyer Show, you just never know what's going to happen next.
So listen for yourself.
Here is Frankie Boyer.
And welcome. It is such a pleasure to have you with us right here on BizTalk Radio. And my first guest, wow, what a new book. You know, I'm always fascinated by creative souls. You know, I think that there's something very special about creative people. And I guess Alan Gannett does too, because he's the founder and CEO of TrackMaven, a software analytics firm whose clients have included Microsoft, Marriott, Saks, Fifth Avenue, Home Depot, Aetna, Honda, and on and on. He's also been on the 30 Under 30 list for both Inc. and Forbes. And his new book is out. It's called The Creative Curve. And Alan had the opportunity to look at some of the most creative people that we know in our culture right now to find out what makes them tick. And it includes interviews with so many. And Alan, welcome. Congratulations on this book.
Thanks for having me.
So how many people did you interview for this book?
So I interviewed 25 people, and it was everyone from, you know, Patek and Paul, the songwriting duo behind Dear Evan Hansen, La La Land, and The Greatest Showman, to Michelin star chefs, billionaires, and sort of everything you can imagine in between.
Wow. What was there a thread that every single one of them had? And by the way, don't forget the flavor team at Ben & Jerry's.
Who are all surprisingly skinny. That's kind of shocking. So one of the threads that I thought was so interesting was that we think of creativity in this way where it's almost inaccessible. But the things that these people do to be extraordinary is really they're ordinary people who do something extra. And so my book is all about that extra. What is it that they do? And there's a couple key themes I found. One of them that I saw over and over again, creatives are also some of the biggest consumers of their field. You know, we think about consumption as almost the antithesis of creativity, right? Consumers consume, creators create. But actually, these really great creatives, one of the things they do is they go very deep in their vertical, consume everything.
Oh, I lost you. Did we lose him? Or is it just my feed? He's not talking, though, right? Alan, are you there? Oh. We have to get him back. Hopefully we can get Alan back. He was saying consumption. So he explores how the science behind the why, consumption of information, can provide your own flashes of genius. And then imitation. This is an interesting one. I wish you were with us to talk a little bit about this. But imitation. Creatives have to find a way to add just the perfect amount of novelty. To do this, they engage in something that may seem surprising imitation. He said they also have creative communities. And Alan shows how building a community. Oh, Alan, I was just reading some of the different initiatives that the threads of imitation and I was just at creative communities.
Yeah, and so one of the things that's so interesting is that, you know, you think of creatives as these solo geniuses, but actually the best creatives work within communities. Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, he had multiple employees from day one. And so we have this idea as creatives as doing it all themselves, but I think that's very dangerous because the best creatives, they're self-aware about their weaknesses, and they go and they find other people who can support those better.
So, Alan, you say in this new book of yours that there's a sense of community, there's an opportunity to see what's been successful from others by imitation. They're ferocious, they are ferocious with their consumption. What's the last piece that they all have in common?
That they don't. The thing that's so interesting is they're not. You know, they're not going to a writer's cabin and writing the book. You hear stories like that, but the vast majority of creatives go through this laborious process. If it's a book, if it's rewriting, if it's a song, it's constantly refining and refining. It's chefs who work on menus, stand-up comedians who work out their jokes for months and months. So we have this idea as creativity is very linear, but in reality, creativity is anything but. And the best creativity comes from that refinement and from that editing of getting it to be that right idea at the right time for the audience by getting it in front of people, getting that feedback, not creating within a vacuum.
That it's so fascinating, isn't it? I mean, really fascinating stuff. And some of the people that you talked with from, as you were saying, best-selling romance novelist, but the chief content officer at Netflix? What was that like?
So the thing that was so interesting is that, you know, you think of Netflix with algorithms, but Ted Sarandos, the chief content officer of Netflix, he started his career as a video store rental clerk. And he watched every single movie in the store. And through that, he realized that so much of movies and taste and films is about what are ideas that are similar to things we like, but different enough to be new and interesting, right? So Star Wars was a Western in space is a classic example. And so what you find is that these creatives go through some period of education where they learn these stuff. They learn these lessons, and that's what translates.
So out of all of the people that you've interviewed through the book, who were your top five that you just sat there and you said, wow, they blew you away?
Well, the one that I'd say is most interesting in a surprising way was I interviewed David Rubenstein, who's a billionaire, co-founder of the Carlyle Group. He's in his late 60s. He's on the board of the Kennedy Center, all this stuff. Sitting down with him, and he starts asking me a bunch of questions. And like almost wouldn't let me interview him. And what I realized was that these really successful people, part of their magic is that they stay hungry, they stay curious even after they become successful. The reason the Beatles weren't one-hit wonders, they adapted, they changed, they learned. You know, they learned all about Eastern instruments, and they brought in the sitar. And so I think that's such an important element.
Yes.
If you want to have a consistent career, you have to be curious.
Absolutely. I think you're absolutely right. And I just saw Bohemian Rhapsody, and the same thing for Queen. They had to constantly change themselves.
Totally. And that's why when people talk about, you know, one-hit wonders, I mean, what I really found, I did a little bit of research that didn't make the book, is that a lot of those one-hit wonders, they basically get, you know, comfy on their laurels, right? They're saying, hey, I have this hit song, I'm great, and their next album is the same album. And people are like, I've heard this before. And so as humans, we like things that we've heard before. We like nostalgia, but we also want that new and novel twist that gets us excited. And you
Absolutely.
Have to learn as an artist how to balance that.
Yes. You know, when you look at one of the young singers that when they put out a new CD, they give hints in social media. They do this intriguing game for their followers. And their followers can't wait for the moment this new CD is dropped. They can't wait for the record to drop. And they've already created that instant hit because of this momentum. It's not just putting out an album. It's the way in which they're doing it.
Yeah, and I think we're entering an age which is going to be so fascinating because people are learning because of how easy technology has made it to be a creator. That a lot of these things which previously seemed magical, like creating music, well, with the right, you know, app downloads on your phone or on your computer, you can be a rap producer, an EDM producer. And
right.
So I think we're entering a new age of creativity.
Absolutely.
Where the tools are more accessible than ever before, and it's more about learning the strategies and the craft. And that's very exciting to me.
Alan, how did you pick your 25 for the creative curve?
So check out thecreativecurve.com. There's a book trailer that features my very adorable corgi, links and sample chapters and all that good stuff.
Wonderful. And with that, we're out of time, but are you pleased with how this book came out?
I'm super happy. It's been fun to see the impact of people who feel like it's both actionable but also empowering. And, you know, that's why you write a book, so.
Yeah, yeah. And to do all of this at such a young age, good for you, Alan. Good for you. Congratulations on The Creative Curve. And that's the website as well. And we appreciate your time today on Biz Talk Radio.
Thanks, Frankie. Bye.
Thank you. And we'll be back in just a moment. This is Frankie Boyer. Stay tuned, Biz Talk Radio.
Now you can watch business videos on demand. Go to bizvod.com for details. That's BIZVOD.com.
And welcome back. It is Frankie Boyer. Joining us now is Dr. Sunita Puri. She's the medical director of the Palliative Medicine and Supportive Care Services at the Keck Hospital in Norris Cancer Center of the University of Southern California, where she also serves as chair of the Ethics Committee. She graduated from Yale, and her new book is out. It's called That Good Night, Life in Medicine in the 11th Hour. And Dr. Puri, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you are very accomplished, and you said that it was during your residency or when you were very young and early into medicine that something changed. What was it that made it so different for you?
You mean in terms of how I chose palliative care?
Yes.
I went into medicine really because I wanted to be just like my mom, who is an anesthesiologist and also a very deeply spiritual woman who showed me that medicine and spirituality can actually be really complementary to each other rather than antagonistic. And I went along in my training really trying to convince myself that I could also be an anesthesiologist or an ICU doctor, someone who was really immersed in the really technologic aspects of medicine. But as I went on in my training, I found that I was not fulfilled the way my mother was with doing procedures and kind of taking care of patients without paying attention to them as whole human beings.
So,
and I had a moment in... I'm sorry.
So explain to us what that means. So we just become a patient without, we become the disease instead of the person behind the disease?
Yes. And I think, and I want to be clear that I think I and my colleagues in medicine all have the best intentions when we come to a critically ill patient or a patient with a very serious illness. And we do everything we can technologically and otherwise to try to save and prolong their lives. But I know from my own experience and from observing in the hospital every day that sometimes we fall into the habit of saying, okay, the kidneys aren't working, so I'm going to do this. The heart's not working well, I'm going to do that. And we lose sight of the complex interplay between organ systems and the quality of life that a person may want for themselves doesn't become our priority. And that's where I felt like I was losing my way as a student, that I was so focused on fixing lab numbers and ordering tests that I was forgetting that a human being, a human spirit inhabited the bodies whose lives I was trying to prolong, if that makes sense.
Yes, yes. And so... your journey, and tell us about the new book, please.
Absolutely. So I just, you know, I'm so thrilled to be talking to you today. It's a really, today a huge dream of mine is coming true because I've always been a writer at heart. It's what if I had the bravery, I would have just made that my career. Although I do love medicine tremendously. So please know that it wasn't a fallback in any way.
Right, right.
But I've always been a writer. I've always read voraciously, and it has always been my dream to write a book. And this book is really about where I came from, what it meant to grow up with Indian immigrant parents who came from extreme poverty and who, through their belief in the divine and their strong sense of spirituality, they were able to create for themselves the lives they have now. So the book is kind of a chronicle of their journey and what I learned from them, and then how I took the lessons I learned into my medical practice and found a home for myself in a really unusual field of palliative care, which aims through teamwork to address the physical, emotional, and spiritual aspects of suffering that patients and their families experience when they're living with a serious disease. So it's really a chronicle of who I am, who my family is, and what it means to do this work and to exist every day in that borderland between life and death.
You know, you have a very big task because we have been a society, doctor, that thought opioids were the answer for chronic for chronic pain. And now we're understanding, not so fast. Maybe not. Mm-hmm. Maybe not.
Certainly. So I think the opiate epidemic has made my work a little bit more complicated. I think what's interesting, though, is that we have many different medications at our disposal to treat pain from cancer. So, for example, if a patient has cancer that's moved into their bones, sometimes the best medicine for that sort of pain is actually not an opiate. And I think as a medical profession, we've become, like, prescribing opiates for pain has become our default, when in fact we have many other types of medicines, sometimes as simple as ibuprofen, that can help tremendously with different sorts of pain that my patients experience. So in a way, I think the opiate epidemic has forced us to dig deeper into our toolkits and to figure out how do we treat pain a bit more precisely than just giving everybody opiates. However, it should be mentioned that for many of my patients, especially with very advanced cancer, we do know that opiates at the right dose are really helpful in restoring their quality of life.
Yes,
but it can be
I'm
a challenge in our new environment.
Yes, yes. But it's that one pill mentality as well that people tend to believe in.
Mm-hmm. And I think pain in particular, and certainly suffering, there's so many aspects to that beyond just the medical or the physical suffering. I think what I've seen often is, I'll give you an example. I have a patient in my clinic who is a lovely, very young woman with widespread breast cancer. And I had seen her in back-to-back visits from one week to another. And sometimes I don't have to change the pain medication regimen, but rather engage with her over the impact of her disease on her family and her child. And you can see when you engage with people in that way that their comfort increases.
Yes.
Or if she's regularly going to a support group or to therapy, her use of pain meds might go down.
It's so fascinating. It's such an awesome task that you have taken on, and we all are grateful for that because we need to understand that we're not just our disease. There's more to the story. And you are showing that in That Good Night. Thank you so much, Doctor. What's the best website?
So my personal website is www.sunitapuri.com, and you can also find the book on Amazon and in any of your local bookstores.
Awesome. Congratulations, and thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll be right back. I'm Frankie Boyer. This is Biz Talk Radio.
Biz Talk Radio is powered by Freedom Solar. Find out more at freedomsolar.com. Biz Talk Radio.
And welcome back. It is Frankie Boyer. And what happens when you have a fear of heights? Well, one would think if you had a fear of heights, you would not become a circus aerialist. You would think that, wouldn't you? Well, guess what? Not necessarily true. Cassandra Polovic is with us today, and that's exactly what she did for a living. Okay, tell us the story, Cassandra, because this is so amazing. Go ahead and tell us what you did for 25 years and you kept it a secret.
Yes, I sure did. I decided one day that I was going to go audition for Ringling Brothers and Barnum Bailey Circus, and as a showgirl, a dancer, and they said, by the way, if you want to be in our show, you have to perform aerial. And at first I was okay about it, but then I thought, oh my God, can I do this? Because I am so deathly frightened of heights, and yet I did, and I kept it a secret. But it was something that was something I really, really wanted to do, was perform and travel, and I didn't want my fear of heights stopping that opportunity that I had, and it was a wonderful career, and I did keep it a secret, but it was something that I had to, for sure, work on every day. I had to definitely. You know, I mean, besides the positive affirmations, which are great, there was action. You know, I had to constantly put in the effort every day. So that was it. That's how I did it.
And every day you did this, you were afraid. You were horribly afraid.
Frankie, yes, I was afraid. And I talk about these positive affirmations, which are good, by the way, but you simply can't mantra your way out of anything without action. So I had to force myself to, I mean, besides preparing and getting yourself ready, getting your body ready, getting your mind ready, you actually had to put action behind those words. And I did. And if I didn't believe in myself, well, then it wouldn't have happened. So I had to believe in myself, but the necessarily, you know, ingredient was action. And it took effort. And about, you know, the only thing that comes without effort, Frankie, would be old age. And even that I questioned as I roll out of bed every morning, you know. But it takes effort, and it takes work and consistency. And it's just the way it is. It's part of life. But I wanted to, like I said, my desire, my will to perform and travel was so much more greater than that fear, even though I struggled with that on a daily basis. And there were good days and there were bad days, you know, but just thank God I made it through, you know. I didn't fall. I didn't hurt myself. So it worked out for me for 25 years, but it was a secret. It definitely was.
Now that you've retired from that field, what was it like, though, going from, many of us, you know, think about joining the circus. Everybody makes a joke about it. Let's go give up everything and join the circus. But tell us about the reality of joining the circus, please.
Well, the reality is, for me, it was never a childhood dream of mine to join the circus. I mean, I just, you know, I just thought, why not? Yes, sure, people laughed, people thought that was crazy, and then some people thought that was, oh my gosh, amazing. You know, I always wanted to be in the circus. I don't know if that is true or not, but It, you know, life on the road was interesting, and much like, I guess, a musician, you're constantly living out of your suitcase, which as a young person, because I was, you know, I had just turned 21 when I joined the circus. So as a young person, that's exciting. You know, it really is. And it is, I had the time of my life being on the road and being in the circus. You learn so much traveling, and you learn so much about people, and it's just the different nationalities and the places you go. So being in the circus, I think, is not too much different, I would assume, than, you know, anybody who's traveling in a band. It's just, you know, it's a different way of life. So going from that life as a performer and an artist, you know, in the circus for 25 years and into what, you know, my family would call the real world. You know what I
mean?
Yes. Welcome to our world, the 9-to-5. I'll tell you what, it was tough. It was really tough because 25 years doing what you love to do, traveling, performing, and meeting these amazing people, working with amazing talent and some celebrities I've worked with, going to from that to, oh my goodness, here I am. What am I going to do? You know, that transition.
Yeah.
You know, was a shock. It was like somebody picking me up from my world as an artist and dropping me off in the middle of China, and I didn't speak the language. So it was rough. It was a tough transition. I went into my cocoon. There's an aerial move that I speak about in my TEDx talks called the cocoon, and that's where you reflect and you think. And what I had to gain the courage to do is start asking for help. You know, what my next career move was. And I did it. I mean, it's part of life, though. You know what I mean, Frankie? It's just part of life. Transitioning in, it's just life. And every phase of your life, there's a transition. It's just how you handle it. And I just looked back on my lessons I learned in the circus, because there were many, and I apply them to my, what my family called, real world, real world life, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Cassandra, do you have any, do you regret that you spent 25 years in this cocoon, as you know, in this world that you call it?
Yeah, my circus world, my artist years. No, I don't regret it. I honestly can say that I did what I really, truly wanted to do, and that was perform and travel. Whether, you know, regardless of it being in the circus, it was still something that I wanted to do. It's still something I actually did. It was just another venue, another way of getting there. I mean, I went to college in Franklin, Massachusetts, at Dean College, and my major was music theater dance. So I knew immediately I didn't want to teach it. I wanted to perform it. And I ended up doing what I wanted it to do. So I don't regret it at all. Not at all. No.
Do you miss the life, though, and the people?
Frankie, I can honestly say I do. And I don't know if it's just because it's in your blood. They say once you're in show business, it's really hard to get out of. And that was, I think that's definitely true for me. Even though I started late, you know, a lot of, I guess 21 is late to start in that career as a show person. But as an artist, as an aerialist, it's not so much. I mean, they, you know, Cirque du Soleil gets a lot of their performers from, you know, championship gymnastic, you know, studios or gyms. So they come straight from there, and boom, they're in the circus.
So here you are, flying on the trapeze, overcoming your fear of heights every single night that you did that, and sometimes a couple of times a day.
Yes, well, flying trapeze is not, it was a sidebar for me. That was, I didn't actually perform the front flying trapeze. I did an aerial act called The Silk, which is a long curtain.
Oh, right, The Silk, yes, we've seen that. Right. That's lovely.
Yes, that I got a little bit more comfortable doing than any other apparatus in the circus, because the silk is just a long curtain, and you can see the silk touching the floor. So if you were to slip up, the chance of you catching yourself on your way down is much greater than if you were on, like I did another aerial act called the Sphere, and if you fall from that, you're falling. There's nothing to grab onto, you know what I mean?
Right,
so,
right.
I mean, all this is in the mind, you know, all this is in the mind, and
so,
the transformation always begins in the mind.
Where are you today? Tell me what your life is like today.
Today, I'm actually on the East Coast. I lived on the West Coast. I lived in Vegas for 21 years as an artist, as a performer. I finished up my career there. I was age 45. My last show, my last performance was the day before I moved back to the East Coast, where I was raised. And now I give inspirational talks. I talk about fear. I talk about transitioning. I talk about those phases of fear.
So give us your, we're out of time. So give us your website, Cassandra, and I know you're working on a book.
Well, I actually really want to work on an audiobook. So yes, that's in the works. But my website is called fearhasnogrip.com. And that actually is not up yet. It'll be up tomorrow, but it's
okay.
called fearhasnogrip.com.
Well, this has been such a great story. We'll be back in just a moment. Thanks for sharing it with us. And we'll be right back. Frankie Boyer, stay tuned. This is Biz Talk Radio.
This is Biz Talk Radio, America's home for business talk. Online at biztalkradio.com.
And welcome back. It is Frankie Boyer. Joining us today, Natalie Alicia Gold, author of the upcoming book, Money Mama. And she teaches women how to protect themselves and their families financially. And as we get closer to the International Women's Day, Natalie, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
When it comes to financial savvy, we are way, way behind. And tell us about the USA Today survey, please.
Sure. The USA
pretty
Today
scary.
Survey, it's pretty insane. The statistic is something like almost 40% of women surveyed in 2018 between the ages of 18 and 34 said that they have trouble paying their bills on time, and they are less likely than men to be saving. A CNBC study tells us that one in three women are concerned about their finances as opposed to one in five men. The statistics are astounding.
So we're not saving.
We're not saving.
And not only are we not saving, but we're having a hard time paying the bills every month.
Absolutely.
So why? What is it? Is it the difference between our salaries, or is it just the difference between our mindset? Is it the difference that we've never been savvy growing up, maybe, or really understanding the financial piece of the story?
I think it's a great question, Frankie. And here's the thing, it's all of those, right? There is no educational platform out there. Even at the best universities, at the best graduate schools, law schools, medical schools, that really teaches financial literacy 101. What does it mean to have compounded interest on saving? Why do we need a life insurance policy? What are the basic documents that protect our family and our future? And this is just not part of our curriculum, no matter which school you go to, which is a major, major issue. So, yes, we're not taught. And then, like you mentioned, we're making 80 cents on the dollar to a man, even today in 2019. And when you take home less money, you bet that the expenses are the same. The expenses, a bill doesn't care if you're a man or a woman. It's going to be the same amount.
That's right.
So when we have 80% less dollars, of course we're going to have a harder time saving.
And what's up with millennials? Where are they in this conversation, Natalie?
I think millennials have gotten the short end of the stick by 10. And you know, I wrote the best-selling book, The Millennial's Guide to the Universe, and I've spoken on many college campuses about this. Millennials, everyone says, are the entitled generation, blah, blah, blah. I think that's absolutely untrue. I think millennials have been sold a bill of goods that, listen, our American dream is you go to college, you get a college education, and that was great for our generations prior where it was $1,000 or $2,000 a year. Now it's $50,000, $60,000. So these young students are taking out so much debt because they believe they have to go to college to be successful. And as a result, I don't know if they'll ever be able to get out of it, Frankie.
Yeah.
It's astounding and scary.
It really is. And it's, and I know, honestly, Natalie, I'm with a group of women that some of them have already opted out because in their early 60s, late 50s, they lost their job. That they had in their career and they didn't want to continue. And so they have, you know, they have a family and they have, you know, they have the luxury of not worrying about whether or not they go to work. But the majority of my friends are still working. And I have a friend that does part-time, part-time stuff from her full-time job that she was in her mid-70s when she retired, and she still takes on a couple of very tiny accounts, but she manages them still at 82.
God bless her. That's amazing.
But that's kind of the way it is.
Yeah. And, you know, Frankie, the crazy stuff is that women so often are kind of putting this decision on happenstance. Like, my company will take care of me. My husband will take care of me. But actually, the National Center for Women in Retirement tell us that 9 out of 10 women outlive their men. And from my practice as an estate attorney in New York and New Jersey, I'll tell you, I think that's even being conservative. I look, when a couple comes to me and thinks about planning, I look at the woman and I say, when you survive him, this is what's going to happen. And unless the women are really empowered to understand the money, they will be scrambling in their 80s and 90s, and that is just unacceptable. We cannot allow our women to be in a position where they could be worried about how do I make next month? How do I survive in this apartment, in this home?
Yeah. Wow.
It's a big problem, Frankie.
It is. And so the new book, when will the book be out, Natalie?
The book is coming out April 16th, which I always said was the best day of the year. It's the day after taxes. It happens to also be my birthday. So Money Mama is coming out April 16th, and I cannot wait because, you know, with this new tax law, everyone is talking about the changes. And
yes.
I think that it will finally wake people up to, okay, maybe this past year didn't go as well as planned. What can we do in the future years to make sure our financials are completely laced up and absolutely protected? Because, Frankie, a woman always thinks about her family and her legacy and what happens if. Typically,
right.
My male clients think they'll live forever. It's something about the male species that they just, you know, are not worried about this.
Well, but the truth is that 39% of women aged 18 to 34 are sharing from this USA Today report that they have trouble paying their bills on time and they're less likely
Absolutely.
To be saving. If you ask men that question, what would they be saying, Natalie? Oh, real quick, we're out of time.
I think they'd be saying, you know, probably something similar, but not as bad because they have learned about the financial education earlier.
And give us your website, please, and we'll have you back
sure.
when the book is out.
I would love that. My website is Ms. M.S. Natalie, N-A-T-A-L-I-E, nation.com. And I would love to, you know, speak to your viewers and really help them in any way I can.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Natalie. And thank all of you. Right. We'll see you next time right here on the Frankie Boyer Show for Biz Talk Radio. Thanks for listening. Make it a great day. And as always,
smile, though your heart is aching. Smile even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by.
if you smile through your fear.